and observable, and which cause some women lots of trouble. And so, in some senses of the word, then it could be considered a disease, but isn't called one, and I didn't mean to reflect on anybody when I said it. Now, of course, some of you are wondering if you can stay awake for the next hour. Please don't feel bad if you fall asleep. I look at it in the hour after lunch as it doesn't, you know, if you fall asleep, I can blame the cook. You know, it wasn't my speaking that got you, or the turkey, or whatever it was that they fed you. And quite on the other hand, sometimes I even take it as a compliment. You think about it. If I were an anesthesiologist and I could simply talk you into unconsciousness, it would be a real event, wouldn't it? Yes. So if you get tired, just stand up. I used to do that all the time when I worked nights in the emergency room and I had to go to church the next morning. If I was sleepy, I'd just go to the back and stand up in the back. And you can't fall asleep standing up. So at least if you do, you don't stay asleep long. All right. Well, we're going to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder right now. In it, I'm going to tell you how I help people who worry. And of all the things I am going to tell you today, this might be the most useful to you. This is very practical. How many of you have people who worry that you talk to? Most of the hands are up here. Now, how many of you worry? Most of your hands are up. That's right. Well, this is what the Bible says. This is the way the Bible says that we ought to deal with it. And a post-traumatic stress disorder, quite frankly, is simply one of those little subsets of the DSM-4 category of worry. It's worry on steroids, whatever you'd like to say. A psychiatric disorder that can occur following the experience or witnessing of life-threatening events such as military combat, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, serious accidents, or personal assault. Now, you wonder about the picture on the bottom, don't you? That's right. Well, you know, my wife says that I have given her post-traumatic stress disorder. You guys know how this goes, don't you? You're driving down the road and you look up, there's a car a half mile up there, you know, and you're just paying attention. And all of a sudden you hear, just like this, you know, and you look over and your wife's feet are up on the dashboard. Any of you guys can vibe with this? Yes, that's right. Yeah. What I can't figure out is how, you know, I've been driving since I was 16 years old at 39 years now, and I've never killed myself yet. And I don't seem to have any near misses when I'm driving alone, but you put my wife in the passenger seat of the car and it's just like a near miss every minute. The truth of the matter is I probably did give my wife some reason to think I was trying to kill her the other day. We were at one of those kind of streets that angles up, you know, it doesn't meet square. It comes in at an angle, and I look to the left, and there's nothing coming, and I look to the right, and of course, the car that's going to hit us is behind my wife's head and in between the windows and that post. And I start to pull out, and everybody's horns start blaring and all this kind of stuff, you know. So there may be some measure to the truth that that my driving leaves something to be desired on occasion. Anyway, that's sort of what post-traumatic stress is about. I have a couple of ladies that I've taken care of and do right now who have a hard time getting in a car because they've been hit by semi-trucks. You know, they're driving along and bang, a truck hits them. They survived it, but it sort of smashed their car. And you know, I can sit there and I can look at them and I can tell them, well, you know, if you keep not driving and you keep sitting in your bathroom and won't come out, you know, eventually, I mean, your life is going to cave in around you, but it doesn't seem to help them. You know, and I can say, well, you know, the odds of you getting hit by another semi-truck are very small. You know, there are lots of cars, there are many roads, and, you know, the odds of you getting run over by another truck aren't too large. The only trouble with that is that they get back out on the road, and guess what's there? You know, there's another semi-truck, and what they worry constantly about then is whether or not that truck's going to miss and hit them. That's a part of post-traumatic stress disorder. My first contact with post-traumatic stress disorder as a physician came through my brother. He's a pastor, and he got a phone call one day about a fellow who was sitting in his van on the back of his property with a gun, and he was going to kill himself. He was a Vietnam veteran, and for reasons which neither my brother or I understand, he decided to go over and see what he could do. And he drove over to the house, walked out to the back of the property, and got in the truck with him. That didn't work out too well. At some point in time, this fellow who was, you know, playing with the gun decided that he'd listened enough to this preacher, and he pointed the gun at my brother. And then he pulled the trigger. Now, the gun didn't go off, and we all have sort of started thinking of all these kind of mythological stories that can come up where, you know, the angel must have been there and stuck his finger between the firing pin and the bullet and all that. You know how that goes, those kind of things. My brother learned two things out of that. One was that your life does pass before your eyes very quickly. And when they call you and tell you that someone is sitting in a truck on the back of their property with a gun, you call the police. And the police go first. Yeah, yeah, that's what they're there for. You know, you don't go out and sit down in a car with a guy with a loaded gun. And then later, when he was talking to a guy at Don's Guns, he figured out that the guy was just playing with him. He had the kind of pistol that, unless there was a bullet in the chamber, when you pull the trigger the first time, it just clicks, and then it'll put a bullet in the chamber, and the next time he pulls it, it'll shoot. So he was just joking with him, sorta. The guy went ahead and killed himself eventually, which raises the question, you know, well, what can we do to help people like this, to keep them from ending up in this state? I have a soldier that I have worked with in the last year. He's a 30-year-old serviceman. He served his country with bravery and distinction in, I think, Iraq for a year. Came back with some injuries incurred during that period of time. He and his wife came to see me because they were not getting along. This was their second or so marriage. There were children from both from prior arrangements. They couldn't talk to each other. It didn't take anything to get into a fight because he was always on the edge of being angry. She worried about his last significant other showing up and taking him away from her. She had children, and they were afraid of him. That would be a good way to put it. They were afraid of him, and they really didn't want to spend the rest of their lives being ordered around like enlisted men, you know. He was very worried about whether or not he could stay in the Army because of his injury and some other problems he'd had. It seemed like, well, you know, if he couldn't make it five more years, he wouldn't get his retirement. And it was very possible that they were going to bump him out because, you know, his injury was such that he might not be able to perform his normal duties. He had sleep problems, I think in part due to sleep apnea. His wife and he didn't think that if he stayed in the Army, they could stay married because, you know, the way things are going right now, my son's in the 82nd Airborne and people are being deployed every other year. You know, you go for a year now, every other year. And, you know, it's like trying to have a wife and children and be gone for a year every other year is, it's bad news if it's going to be that way. I think it was better in World War II where the guys left and just didn't come back for 5 years. And everybody knew why they weren't coming back for 5 years. And we all knew that if they came back too soon, we'd all be dead and goose stepping and worshiping Adolf Hitler and so on and so forth. So, here we have a soldier who, you know, he's angry, he's worried, he's fearful, he's hurt, he is patriotic, God-fearing, he has served our needs. You know, he went in our place, and the question is what can we do to help him? You know, what can we do to help a person who is in this kind of setting? Now, post-traumatic stress disorder is the kind of thing that has changed down through the history, I was reading 1776 this past year, and in it, you know, it talks about George Washington and how during the Revolution it was exhilarating to him to be shot at because they missed. And there are these stories of how he had holes in his uniform, you know, and he had horses shot out from under him and stuff like that. And there is a certain amount of thought that God certainly was protecting him during all that period of time. But I mentioned that to my son, you know, who's the second lieutenant, and he's the guy who jumps out of airplanes. He's a Army Ranger, and he said George Washington would have lasted about 2 seconds on a modern battlefield. He'd have sat up on that horse, and somebody 500 yards away would have put a bead on him and blown him right off of it, and they wouldn't have missed. The reason why everybody got shot at and missed so much during the Revolutionary War is they didn't have rifling on the insides of the barrels. And the reason why they all lined up and shot at once at each other is because they were hoping to hit somebody. You know, and there was a significant percentage chance that they wouldn't. You know, after about 100 feet, the bullet would start going wherever it wanted to because it wasn't spinning on its trajectory and keeping a straight line. So we didn't see much post-traumatic stress disorder during the Revolutionary War. You know, you were either dead or you made it, I suppose. It changed, though, with the Civil War. And with that, we see something called the Costa Syndrome, people who could not go back into battle. And the reason why it changed was because war tactics didn't change. The tactics of war didn't change, but equipment did. Rifling in barrels. They had bullets that were as big as your thumb. And they moved at a speed, my son tells me, at which, that when they hit you, they were going slower than bullets do today, and they would take more junk in with them. And as a result, since it took so much junk in with it, you would most certainly die of infection if you were hit by a bullet in any major part of your body. You know, it was just a bad outcome almost always guaranteed. And not only that, they still lined up across from each other in the field and walked right at each other and then shot. The only difference was, is they hit. You know, I mean, it's like Gettysburg, where Lee marches his army up against the Union, and when it's all over with, there's nobody there. They had shot almost everybody out on the field, and you know, and the Confederate Army was laying dead or getting to be that way. So at that point, then we had, you know, folks who looked at that and said, "I'm not going back out there. I don't care if you tell me to go there or not." You know, and that was DaCosta syndrome. Then in World War I, it became shell shock. Again, you know, we became more efficient at killing. Artillery could shoot farther, and when it landed, it had big explosive charges in it. And they, at that point in time, surmised that the reason why people had shell shock was because the shell would explode near them, not kill them, but the concussion would hit your head and would somehow change your brain. Yeah, well, that wasn't it, but it wasn't a bad thought, but that wasn't what happened. It still was an emotional response to a terrible event. In World War II, we started to see even more of it. Not so much because of change in tactics and equipment, but because we got better at health care. You know, if you were shot during prior to World War I, any place significant, you were going to die. And at World War I, they started knowing how to do transfusions. And because of that, men were saved on the battlefield. By World War II, we moved health care closer to the front where the battle was. By Vietnam, we had moved it even closer. And now, right now, you know, if you get shot on a battlefield right now, there's somebody on that field. My son can start IVs. I mean, you know, he didn't go to medical school. Everybody on the battlefield knows how to take care of critically injured people. And not too many feet behind them is somebody who's going to grab them and carry them off. And within a half mile, there is a surgical unit waiting there to fix them. And because of that, lots more men survive. We've only lost, I think, 2,500 or 3,000 men in Iraq. We've got 10,000 or 15,000 men wandering around without parts right now. I mean, you know, they've lost legs, arms, they've been shot. You know, the injured part of this has risen considerably, which also means then that you have lots more people coming back from the front who can have what is called post-traumatic stress disorder. All right, so changes in tactics, changes in the battlefield, changes in healthcare, I'll bring this about. Now, what is the definition? If we're going to help people have this, what's the definition? Well, a person has been exposed to a traumatic event, experienced or witnessed, or was confronted with death or injury. The person's response is involved in intense fear, helplessness, or horror. How many of you have seen Lemony Snicket's? Yeah, Jim Carrey, you know, he's stuck at the end in the car and the train is coming and he can't get out, you know, and he's just watching the train come. That's kind of what this is about, you know. It's like something's bearing down on you or it's going to hit you and there's no way to escape. All you can do is sit there and be mortally afraid. That traumatic event is re-experienced in recurrent and intrusive and distressive recollections of the event, including images, thoughts, dreams, and dreams of the event. You know, these people are apt to wake up out of a dream beating somebody next to them. You know, that can happen. And you know, if you have someone in counseling who seems otherwise normal and they've been arrested for hitting their spouse, and they say they don't remember it and they were asleep, it's called REM behavior disorder. And it's what happens is they are dreaming about being attacked, and it's like sleepwalking. You know, you start thrashing because you're seeing it all over again, and you're trying to do whatever it is you're going to do in order to get away from it, and unfortunately somebody is within arm's length and they get hit. Now, this isn't purposeful. You know, it has to do with being in REM sleep. And a person like that, they need to be talking to a sleep doctor before they end up in jail. Acting and feeling as if they are reliving the experience. They can be with you, but they think that the same things are happening to them again, particularly when they're exposed to things that remind them of what happened to them before. It's like being a soldier off the battlefield who's struggling with this and having, you know, hearing the car backfire. And boom, man, you know, you're ducking, you know, looking for cover. Why? Well, because somebody just shot. Well, no, you know, he shot at you. It was a car backfire, but, you know, they perceive it differently. Or the lady who's been raped and who then looks at all men in the same way. You know, it's like he looks like the guy who did it, you know, and then from then on is uncomfortable. All right. These folks will persistently avoid anything associated with the event, thinking, feeling, conversations, activities, places, or people. It's like the young man who goes to our church, doesn't anymore. He used to go to our church, and the family had his mother's funeral in the auditorium, and he won't go back in there, you know, because that's what he thinks about every time that he goes. You know, that's a strange way of looking at it, but that's exactly how he looks at it. The last funeral we had out of our church, they didn't have it in the auditorium on purpose. And the reason why they didn't want to have it in the auditorium is because they didn't want to be reminded every time they came to church of that event in their life. Sometimes folks with this will be unable to recall important aspects of the event. Their personalities will change. They'll have diminished interest in things which used to interest them much. They will feel detached from others. They sometimes won't have a wide range of emotion. And we call that flat affect. You know, the person that doesn't smile, doesn't cry, just sort of is there. I was sort of looking for a flat affect, but I won't point it out. Anyway, they also live with this idea that they're not going to live very long. You know, and that's born out of the fact that they were shot at and missed. You know, they came close and weren't killed. These individuals as well will have persistent symptoms of increased arousal, sleep disturbances, anger, difficulty in concentration, hypervigilance. Hypervigilance means that you're always looking for incoming. And they'll have exaggerated startle responses. This has to go on for more than a month to qualify. And after 6 months, they call it chronic. That's the definition. Now, what is done about it in the world? Well, you know, I gave you a website thing at the front of your notes, and that's to the VA. And I'm going to tell you something that's really very surprising. Well, it's not real surprising, but it might surprise some of you. You can go to that website, and they'll tell you what they do for post-traumatic stress disorder people. And honestly, what they do isn't bad. You know, 80% of what they do is actually very good. You know, might be hard to say, but it's true. You know, that what they're telling, 80% of what they tell soldiers to do who are struggling with reliving and being caught and stuck back in what happened to them, you know, in out on the field, 80% of this is good. They look first to modify their behavior and their lifestyle through education and support groups. Support groups. That sounds like a small group or something like that, doesn't it? I remember once I said that to a psychiatrist person. They were talking about group. They always talked about group. Well, they had small groups, you know, for folks. And I said, oh, just like Sunday school. And you should have seen the look that came across that person's face. Huh? Sunday school? No, no. Anyway, so support groups, relaxation techniques, recreation, getting them off of it and out into the street and doing and running. Work, a job. You know, about the last thing in the world a person who's struggling with worry and difficulties like this is to sit around and think about it all day. You know, a good hard job that you have to spend 8 to 10 hours a day makes the day go faster, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. And you can kind of get lost in the flow of it so that you don't have to spend your whole day thinking about what it is that you're trying to avoid. So work is good. Exercise is good. I can't think of anything in life besides obstructed coronary arteries that exercise isn't good for. You know, it's probably not real good if you have 90% LAD lesion. Won't work out well for you there. But in most everything else in life, exercise is good. Service to others. Yes, the VA tells these guys that one of the ways that they can find out of this mess in life is it's like, go do things for people who are worse off than you and who need help. That way it gets your nose out of your own belly button and start looking at other people's problems and trying to help them. That's a good suggestion. Building friendships instead of going out and sitting on the, you know, your burned out car on the back of your property, you know, flipping your gun back and forth from hand to hand, you know, instead having friends. These individuals, the VA says, need a safe environment at home and at work. It would be certain that you would say that you would not take a soldier who's had great difficulty out of the battlefield in Iraq and send him to L.A. to be a policeman. You know, it just wouldn't work. You know, there'd be dead Los Angelenes all over the place before it was over with. Yeah, because anytime anything came down, he'd just go right into the mode that he was supposed to be in when he was out there on the field. I you know, when my son got back from Ranger school, I decided at that point in time that I didn't think I wanted to arm wrestle him anymore. Because I figured they probably taught him 15 different ways to kill me in a heartbeat, you know. So, yeah, these men are trained to fight. That's what the Army's all about. So they need a safe environment at home and work, and I would tell you it also needs to be the kind of environment that they perceive as safe. It's not just, you know, what we would think would be safe. They need to view it as safe. The Army will tell them to avoid destructive coping habits like drugs, alcohol, anger, violence, cigarettes, you know, any of these things that people often use to make up the difference between how I'm doing and how I feel about life. The Army would tell them to avoid that. Now, at this point, the Army and I, this is the 20% that I think doesn't work, all right? The next thing the Army would do is send them to cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy is sort of a little bit like me and those poor ladies who are, you know, afraid of driving the truck. You know, ma'am, you're not going to get hit by a truck again. You're just going to have to trust me on this, you know. It's taking someone who's mortally afraid of someone and something and then telling them that they shouldn't be afraid of it. Has that worked well for you? I mean, just telling people that they shouldn't worry and that they shouldn't be afraid, I've never found it to be very useful. And, you know, why should they take my word for it? And cognitive behavioral therapy does have a downfall in that regard. Even at its best, when the motive for making the thinking and behavioral changes, your life is going to be wrecked if you don't change your mind. That is an improper motive, isn't it? Yeah, it's a low motive. It's a low-grade selfish motive. The only reason why I'm going to change the way I think and change the way I act is because it'll be good for me if I do so. That's not the kind of motive that causes people to make significant, difficult change. All right? The only motive that can cause people to make significant and difficult change is, I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. then people can make significant sacrifices and significant changes, all right? So that's the error or the fault in cognitive behavioral therapy. Another thing they use is what they call exposure therapy, which I found not to be very useful. That's where they take people to safe environments and tell them to relive the events that cause them to worry. And they think that because they mull these things through in their minds while they are in a safe environment, that when it's over with, it'll be okay. Again, I have not seen that work well. Other medical care that needs, the things that need to be fixed, sleep disturbances always need to be addressed. People who are in difficult situations like this need to sleep. Physicians can help with this. And I believe it's, you know, our job to step in there and get that done. Chronic medical problems that adversely affect sleep and mood, according to the VA, need to be treated. And of course, they would say that we should be treating folks with medication for depression and medication for worry. By the way, those are my two granddaughters. Sleep. You know, that was the reason why it ended up on the picture. Yeah, little Eve and Abby. No, Allie. Sorry. My wife corrected me almost immediately. Out in the wings there. Now, what does the Bible have to say about people who have anything like this? All right. Well, it's not like I'm going to try to tell you that I'm going to go back 2,500 years and diagnose Elijah with post-traumatic stress disorder. But what I am going to tell you is that he manifests a lot of behavior which looks a lot like it. And then God deals with it. And the way God deals with it has some clues in how we might deal with it. All right. Now, Elijah. Elijah was a man just like us in 1 Kings chapter 18 and 19. My dad would say that Elijah was a man just like us. He put his pants on one leg at a time. You know, there's a phrase for that in history. It's when you reach over and rip something out of history and put it in the wrong time. And I forget what the word is. But, of course, Elijah didn't wear pants. You know, I mean, he wore a robe or something like that. Didn't have pants on. But he was. That's what James says. Elijah was a man of like passions, just like we are. You know, Elijah could worry. Elijah could be afraid. And it said that when Elijah prayed, God held the rain up for 3.5 years. And then when he prayed again after the contest with the 500 prophets of Baal, it says that the heavens gave rain and the earth produced its crops. Elijah was a man just like us, and God paid attention to him when he prayed. He had a very significant traumatic event in his life. Ahab had been looking for him for a good long time with the hope of killing him, because Ahab was convinced that the reason why it wasn't raining in Israel was because Elijah had prayed and it wasn't raining. They met, and Elijah gave the challenge, and you probably know the story. You bring your prophets, I'll come. Bring your altar. You can't cheat, can't put a fire underneath it. You'll pray, and then I'll pray, and we'll see who is God. And, of course, you know how the story goes. The prophets of Baal made their altar, and they cut themselves and cried and yelled and screamed up until noon. Then Elijah very calmly built his altar, poured 12 barrels of water over it, I think, or something like that, and the water covered the altar, which was, of course, done so that he could show that there wasn't any fire underneath. That was the old trick, you know. They would hide fire underneath and then pull out a trap door, and the fire would burn the sacrifice up, and all the people in the crowd, like a bunch of bumpkins, would go, "Ooh, look at that!" And he dug a ditch around the altar, and the water filled the ditch up, and then he got down on his knees and prayed, and boom, you know, right down from heaven, fire came, bang, consumed the sacrifice, the stones, and lick the water out of the ditch. You know, that was what God, the power that God was willing to execute when Elijah asked him. And then Elijah gets up and tells the people of Israel, stand up, and guess what they're saying at this point? The Lord, He is God. Well, what do you think they'd say? You know, it's like, you know, this is obvious. And then he says, well, don't let any of the prophets of Baal escape. And they captured 500 of them, took them down to the brook, and killed them. 500 guys. You think about it. How long does it take to kill 500 people? I mean, that means that they were whacking them with a sword, you know, who knows how many at a time, and Elijah was in there whacking. You know, I don't know how many Elijah killed, but he killed a bunch, along with the rest of the people there. significant. It's like that scene in The Patriot when Mel Gibson is killing that British soldier who killed his son, and he's just whacking him to pieces, you know. That's exactly what they were doing. And they whacked these 500 guys to pieces. They killed them all. Significant traumatic event, wouldn't you say? Yeah, it qualifies. So, after that, you know, Ahab goes home. Guess he tells his wife, tells little Jezebel, 110-pound center of moral evil in the world at the time, that guess what happened today, honey? We had a contest, and your prophets lost, and your prophets are dead. And so what does Jezebel do? She sends word down to Ahab, or rather to Elijah. You know, so be it for me, and if by tomorrow you're not just like one of them, I'm going to kill you. Now think about that for a minute. You just prayed. God has sent fire down from heaven. He's consumed the sacrifice, the stones and the water. And you just killed 500 guys, 500 men. And a 110-pound woman sends you a message and says she's going to kill you. Now explain this to me. I don't understand it. Because what does Elijah do next? He runs. Yes, man. He turns and runs. Jezebel must have had a significant reputation in Israel, is all I've got to say. Because he breaks and he runs. And he runs. I guess you could say he was tired. That would be reasonable. He was traumatized. That would be reasonable. Was it an irrational fear? Wasn't it irrational for Elijah, who'd prayed and asked God to burn up the sacrifice and just killed 500 guys, to be afraid of one woman? Wasn't it? Yeah, it was irrational. Didn't make any difference. He was still afraid of her. And he runs. And he runs for a day. And then he sits down and falls asleep. And God sends an angel to take care of him. And he shakes him and wakes him up and feeds him, waters him. And then Elijah falls asleep again for another day, and he gets up, and God feeds him again. The angel feeds him again and waters him again. And then guess what he does? Well, first, when he sits down, when he runs in, and when he collapses the first time, he recites that famous prayer, and he sits down under that juniper tree. You know, everybody talks about being like Elijah under a juniper tree. And he says, you know, God, you know, kill me. You know, I've served you. They've forsaken your altars and they want to kill me. It'd be just okay if I die right now. That's what he tells God. And then he falls asleep. But then after he slept for a day and had time to reflect on it, and an angel is feeding him. Think about that for a minute. You know, is this rational? I mean, you know, if you've got an angel standing beside you to take care of you, is it rational for you to be afraid? No, not at all. So what does he do then? He runs. And how long does he run? Anybody remember? 40 days. 40 days distance into the wilderness to Mount Horeb. And then when he gets there, he moves into a cave and sits down. Then God comes and talks to him. And what does he tell God? Well, God, I served you. They've forsaken you. They want to kill me. And I alone am left. I alone am left. That was his delusion, wasn't it? Because he wasn't alone. He wasn't the only Israeli who was willing to serve God. He met the... So he says his life would be short, and he also meets the 30-day criteria, doesn't he, by default? He's out there running for 40 days, so he blasts past the 30-day criteria to have post-traumatic stress disorder. All right, so let's say that safely Elijah looks like somebody who has post-traumatic stress disorder, and let's look at what God did to help him. All right? What did God do to help him? Well, the first thing is that God let him run. That's right. Elijah's natural inclination and fear was to run, and God didn't stop him. And I'll tell you, when counselees show up and they are distressed, distraught, broken, crying, devastated, you know, that's probably an appropriate time to let them cry for a while. You know, the problems that they face are real. You know, they really did see these things. They really are in trouble. And you know, at the outset, You know, God didn't grab Elijah up by the scruff of his neck. He didn't send an angel to knock him down and turn him around and send him back. He let him run for 40 days before he did anything about him. Think about that for a moment. You know, it's inappropriate to give people a little space, I guess. And then the next thing he does is he puts Elijah where? He puts him in a place that Elijah thinks is safe. Doesn't he? Yeah. Elijah, would Elijah have been safe if he were standing in the in Jezebel's palace in front of Jezebel? Yeah, Elijah would have been safe there, wouldn't he? Yeah, I believe he would have. God was going to take care of him. Now, would have Elijah believed that? No, not in a heartbeat. You know, he was convinced that he was a dead man and Jezebel was going to do it to him. So God puts him someplace a long way away where he believes he is safe. And I can tell you that when you're dealing with somebody who has post-traumatic stress disorder, they need to be someplace at the outset where they don't believe they're threatened. That I think that's important. Then he lets Elijah sleep. I believe it's also important for us to make sure that counselees who are struggling with this kind of problem are sleeping well and sleeping as normally as possible, and that you'll need a doctor to help you with, you know, at the outset. Then God met Elijah's food and water needs, didn't he? I guess you could say that Elijah was out where he was out because of his own disobedience and fearfulness, right? Wouldn't you say that? Yeah. I mean, it was just simply a lack of faith on his part, was it not? Yes. Yeah, it was. He just didn't believe God could take care of him where he was at the time. I suppose God could have said something like some of us might. You know, when he gets hungry and thirsty enough, he'll come back. Ever say that about your dog? Whenever the dog gets hungry and thirsty enough, he'll come back. I'm not going to go out and look for him. I suppose God might have taken that attitude with Elijah. You know, if I don't feed him wherever he's headed, then he'll come back. But instead, no. God provided for his needs running the wrong way. All that time and took care of him. You know, there are times when people who are in this situation are going to be physically capable of taking care of their needs, and they are responsible to do so, and they won't. And, you know, we who love them and who stand around them, their relatives, loved ones, friends, fellow church members, it's our job to take care of them right then. You know, sometimes people won't be responsible, and it's our job to help them while we move them back to their responsibility. Running for Elijah is a lot like work. Physical work is good. It always is. My dad always said that, you know, the greatest sleeping pill in the world was a hard day's work. And my next door neighbor, her corollary to that, she was a physician. She would always say that the best sleeping pill in the world was a clear conscience. You know, a hard day's work and a clear conscience. You can usually go to bed and sleep at night. These individuals need to be working at something. And I've taken people. I remember the anorectic lady I took care of. We made her get a job. She was on disability and nobody would hire her. So her family took her and put her to work in the family business. And the family business was a donut shop. Anorectic donuts, oh well. Anyway, yeah, it was sort of funny at the time. She needed that. She needed to be occupied. These people needed to be occupied, even if they are working, doing volunteer work at church, digging ditches. They need physical labor and something to occupy their time. I also noticed in all of this that God was very patient with Elijah, wasn't he? Yeah, he was. He listened to Elijah whine, didn't he? Yeah, he did. And you know, Elijah, God never really answered most of Elijah's whining. If you go back and read the text, he just lets him talk. And what did God finally do that turns Elijah around the other way? Well, he showed himself, didn't he? Yeah, he showed Elijah himself in the wind and fire and all that. And I tell you, I counselees who are in this situation, they need to see Jesus. They really do. They need to see Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. They need a Hebrews 4:14 through 16 Savior that has been tested in the same way we've been tested, yet without sin, who suffered our infirmities. They need to see Jesus Christ down on his hands and knees in Gethsemane asking God for a better way out of it. They need to see Jesus Christ in being tried unjustly. They need to see Jesus Christ beaten and nailed to a cross. They need to see Jesus Christ at the seaside reclaiming Peter, who denied him. That's who they need to see as we counsel them. They need an object of faith worth trusting. That's what they need. And so eventually God got down to confronting Elijah. And what does God do with him? Well, first thing that he did was he dispelled Elijah's delusion, didn't he? Yeah. First thing he does is tells him to go back to work. He said, your job is 40 days back that way, and you might as well get going. And then he tells him, he gives him those instructions, and then he tells him that, by the way, there are 7,000 left in Israel who've not bowed their knee to Baal. Yeah, you're not alone, and you never were. You're not alone, and you never were. So God confronts him finally, which is exactly what we have to do eventually. All right, that's Elijah. PTSD is simply worry and fear. Let's look at Luke chapter 12 and verse 4. Between Luke 12 and Matthew 6, Jesus puts together two things I know go together as I watch people with generalized anxiety disorder, phobias of all sorts, post-traumatic stress disorder, worry and fear. They're really all part of the spectrum. And I'm going to tell you what Jesus tells them. Sometimes, you know, I'll say things to people in counseling and they look at me like I've lost my mind. And the only problem is it's a quote. You know, and I didn't say it. You know, it was Jesus Christ who said it. I'm just repeating it. Luke chapter 12, verse 4. I say to you, my dear friends, do not be afraid. I think that's an imperative in Greek. Of those who kill the body and after that have no more than they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 cents, yet not one of them is forgotten before God? Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not, what? Fear. Yeah, do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. And I say, everyone who confesses me before men, the Son of Man will confess him before the angels of God. But he who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. Here's the problem outlined. You have something or someone who really frightens you. You desire to avoid it or change it, and that desire becomes so great that it becomes the reason why you live. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's why you're going to live. It determines what your choices will be, and in essence, it becomes what you worship. You worship safety. And you'll sacrifice everything else in its path. You know, that's when you think of someone with agoraphobia, that's it, isn't it? I'm safe in my bathroom, and I've sacrificed everything else in the world to stay there. In Matthew 6 and Luke 12, Jesus outlines the things we choose to worry about. In verse 4, it's physical safety. In verses 11 and 12, it's opinions of others. In verse 15, it's every form of greed, particularly greed for food, clothing, and possessions. You can get, in verses 17 through 21, you can get retirement out of it. And in verse 25, even our appearance, we can worry about it. And the cure then is in verse 31. It says, seek his kingdom first, and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Don't worry. Don't be afraid. To the soldier whose life is crumbling under the weight of worry and fear of things past that might happen again, the answer is faith. Faith in God. Faith in a God who will provide you with all that you need. All the safety that you need, all the food that you need, all the all the money that you need, all the friendship that you need, everything that you need, right? Philippians 4:13, my God shall supply all your needs. The only problem that most people have with God supplying all their needs is that they want to write the list. Yeah, I want to write the list. I don't want God to write the list. If God writes the list, I don't get everything I want, right? Yes, that's true. Now, in Matthew 6, we come upon what I call the nuclear bomb to fix worry. Whoops. And it's the Lord's Prayer. Yeah. If I sat down across from a counselee and I told them, well, part of your assignment today is I want you to go home and I want you to say 25 Our Fathers. What denomination would you say that I came from? Huh? Catholic. Yes, Catholic. And it's with a grudging tip of the hat to that poor priest who sat down across from that nervous lady one day and said, go home and say the Lord's Prayer 25 times, would you? You know why he told her that, maybe? At least I hope it was. It was because he was hoping that by number 25, she understood what she was saying, you know? And sometimes we have to say things over and over again until we get it, don't we? Yeah, so how does it go? Our Father, who art in heaven. I guess this only works for Christians, doesn't it? We really can't take biblical counseling up and turn it into a Stephen Covey book with seven principles that if you'll just follow the principles, you'll get better. Can we? No, we can't, because, you know, God doesn't want people who aren't Christians to get better, does he? No, he wants them to get saved. And sometimes being miserable is part of being driven towards a God who loves you, isn't it? Was it Lewis said? Pain is God's megaphone, isn't it? Yes. So, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Right? So I guess when we say hallowed be your name, we're worshiping him. We're not worshiping the opinions of other people, are we? No, we're no longer fixated with what people might think about me if they saw me this way, or what people might do if, you know, or whatever. We're no longer, how did Welch put it? We're no longer bound by the fear of people who are bigger than God in our lives. Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy will. Yes, I'm willing to be on your plan. You know, if I say that and I mean it, that means that if God doesn't want me to have it, or God doesn't want me to do it, or God doesn't want me to be there, I'm not going to be, and I'm going to be content in the state that he leaves me, right? Yeah, so if you're willing to let God to determine where he wills you to be tomorrow, when you get there, you're not going to have to worry about it, are you? No. And if you try to pull out on the interstate and there's 10 miles of traffic in front of you and you know you can't get there, you don't have to get mad, do you? No. Well, because if it had been God's will, you'd either left an hour earlier or there wouldn't have been that wreck, right? Yeah. Yeah, if it's God's will, then I don't have to be worried, fearful, or angry about the outcomes. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. You know, you guys can only eat one cheeseburger at a time. Seriously. And if you eat two, you probably shouldn't when you think about it, right? Yes. What does God promise to give us? What we need today. Yeah, and you know what? Folks get all wound up about retirement and their 403b programs, and you know, and their smiles, their frowns and their smiles fluctuate with the stock market. You know, if it's going up, they're smiling. If it's going down, they're frowning. You know, you don't have to worry about retirement if you're working for a God who promises to supply all your needs for the rest of your life. Right? Yeah. If you're willing to work for a God who will supply your needs, all your needs every day for the rest of your life, that means that on the last day you don't need it anymore. You that's it, right? Yeah, and so then you don't have to worry about retirement. I'm not saying you shouldn't plan for it, but you don't have to worry about it, do you? And you don't have to be fearful of it. So give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. If we as Christians on a daily basis make sure that we confess those sins and seek to grow and change so that we don't head right back in them like the dog returns to its vomit every morning. That's really graphic, isn't it? Like a dog returns to its vomit is a fool that repeats its folly. That's what doing that same sin over and over and over again is. But if we confess those sins every day, we don't have to carry around the burden of having them anymore, do we? I don't know about you, but I do things that are wrong. Don't you? Some of you? There are some of you out there who aren't perfect yet. Yes. And don't you know what the burden feels like when you have to carry it for a while? Yeah, I'm so glad to get out from under that burden. There have been times when I've dreamed that I have robbed a bank. This is a recurring thing with me. I'll dream that I've robbed a bank. And then I wake up, and it takes me a little bit, but then I realize I didn't do it, you know? And it's just like a load is lifted off your shoulders. That's what confessing sin is, isn't it? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. That means if we're willing to forgive people who've wronged us, or we're willing to turn them over to God until they come and ask us to forgive them, and we don't have to think about them every day, then we don't have to worry about them, do we? We don't have to worry about spending the rest of our life trying to figure out how to get even with that person who did that great harm or wrong to us, do we? I guess we can't keep lists. That's what 1 Corinthians 13 says. Love does not keep lists. So forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. I guess that means every day we can pray and ask God to kind of guide and direct our lives around those chuck holes when we get up in the morning, can't we? I guess that means we don't have to look at pornography if we don't go where it's at. I guess that means that we don't have to dress in a suggestive manner and trap men in that way, do we? You know, things that men and women can become involved in. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. I guess, you know, if you want to not worry, all you have to be willing to do is to pray the Lord's Prayer. You have to be willing to have the right motive to change. I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. You have to be willing to look at the problems of life in a Romans 8, 28 and 29 sense, don't you? That's right. You have to be willing to look at the oncoming train of life. You can look at problems in life three ways. One of them is that it's an oncoming train with a headlight, and I'm going to stand on the tracks. Thank you. And guess what happens? Boom, you get run over by it, don't you? Or you can jump off to the left, and you can say, that was the worst thing that could happen to me in my whole life. That person is horrible. You know, this is wicked, and I am a victim. And I intend to spend the rest of my life being a victim. That's one way to jump off. Or you can jump off on the right side of the tracks, and as the train goes by, you see Joseph, you know, in the window. And what is he telling you? They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. Yeah, the reason why we have this problem with God creating evil is because we want to assign goodness or badness to events in life based on what we think of them. God just looks at them as events. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. The individual has to look at life that way. And then we have, of course, to do what James told us. When we come into trials, we have to count it all joy. Yes, we have to count it all joy. Just like Jesus counted it joy going to the cross of Calvary, didn't he? Yeah, that's what it says in Hebrews 12. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Yes, we can have the same joy when we see problems or frights or fears coming that Jesus had when he looked at the cross of Calvary. And that joy was going to be how God was going to change us, you and me, and the world and redemption. And again, when we look at those problems and we can have joy, it's because we can look at those problems and say, God's going to change me. He's going to make me more like Christ, and that will be a good outcome. Now, turn in your Bibles to Philippians 4, 4 through 9. I'm going to give you 6 steps of dealing with worry. I teach these to worried people all the time. I didn't read this in a book. This came to me on a day when I was worried. Do I worry? Sure. Don't you? Yeah, you do. Philippians 4, 4 through 9. Yes, 6 steps on how to deal with worry. This came to me one morning when I was having a really good reason to worry. This is what you need to teach the person who's worried about their safety. That's the post-traumatic stress disorder person. This is what you need to teach the person who's worried about their safety. That's the agoraphobic person. This is what you need to teach the obsessive-compulsive disordered person who's worried about order. You know, like What's going to happen to me if my shirts aren't all lined up the right way? This is what you have to teach the person who just worries about everything. You know, that general anxiety disorder type person. This is what you have to teach them. Okay, so the first step of dealing with worry, I always say, is pray. Pray and tell God about it. That was what Peter did when he was standing on the water, wasn't it? Yeah, and he got his eyes off of Jesus and started looking at the storm, which is why most of us worry, isn't it? Yeah, we're walking on the water and we're going real well with Christ and we start looking at the waves around us and poof, man, we're up to our necks in no time at all in worry. And what did Peter say? Lord, save me. Yeah, and it's just time for three words here. And Jesus reaches down, grabs him by the hand and pulls him back up, right? So the first thing you should do is pray. Now, the second thing you ought to do when something happens in your life and you can't, it's something you cannot do anything about, you cannot change it, and over which you have no control, and that you're going to have to live with, and you don't view as positive, which if it was, you know, if it was, if you got a $20,000 bonus from your boss, we wouldn't be talking about this, would you? No. No. You'd say, well, that was great. Unexpected and great. But if it's something that you view and it's not going to be good, what's the first thing you ought to do in verse 4? Can I hear you say that a little louder? If you'd say it really loud, I'd know you were awake. Yes. You should rejoice. Yes. I told that to people and they thought, well, you are a cold-hearted so-and-so. That's what you are. How dare you tell me to rejoice? Well, I smile and say, I didn't. I didn't tell you to rejoice. No, it wasn't my idea. It was the guy who was in chains in prison who told you to rejoice. That's what I tell him. The guy who wrote those words was sitting in prison, chained to the wall. Yes, and he said, rejoice in the Lord when? Always. Again, I say rejoice. And that's in the imperative. What's an imperative, all you grammarians? It's a command. Yeah, it's not a suggestion. It's not a really good idea. It's what God is telling you to do. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. And how are you going to have joy? Just like James said you're supposed to. You're looking forward to what perseverance and maturity is going to be grown in you as a result of dealing with this problem. And then what's the next thing you're supposed to do? It says, let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Yeah, Jesus is watching. Yes, let your gentleness be evident to all. How does that fit? Did you ever kick a dog? Did you ever have a dog that was yours and was being aggravating and you just had enough and you gave it the boot? Nobody will admit to it? Oh, well, I did. I was almost exiled to the mini barn over it, too. I came home after a bad day at work one day and we had a miniature schnauzer. And miniature schnauzers are known for jumping up and down on their claws on the tile, making lots of noise because they want your attention. Wrong day for this. Yes, and the dog was doing that, and I'd had a really bad day, and I just booted it across the room before I realized what I'd done. And the kids looked at me just like that. Yes, their mouths were open. My wife looked at me just like that, and I knew immediately that I had done it. I was in the doghouse, not the dog, yes. Oh, what had I done? I had let my discomfort with my day decide how I was going to act, didn't I? Yes, that's exactly right. My gentleness was not obvious, was it? No, no, my misbehavior was what was obvious. What that means is that you can't let the problem that you're facing decide how you're supposed to act at that moment. You can't. The Bible's supposed to decide how you're supposed to act. And when people look at you in the middle of the trial, what are they supposed to see? Your gentleness, your forbearing spirit. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is at hand. And then what does he say? Be anxious for nothing. What's that mean? Don't worry. Yes, don't worry. Well, that's easy for you to say. As my secretary said, I was working really hard on conducting my choir and orchestra for Christmas, and I said, well, I'm having to do my worry drill now. You know, it's like his life is really getting kind of tense here. And I said, and this is what Paul told me I should do. And she said, yeah, it was easy for him. He was chained in jail, and he wasn't going to have to direct your choir, was he? Yeah. I thought it was really funny myself. But anyway, don't worry. That's not a suggestion, is it? No, it's in the imperative again. We're commanded not to have a divided mind. We're not supposed to worry. We're not supposed to be dividing off half our brain and leaving it there to think about the problem while we're trying to struggle to get the rest of our work done with the other half of our brain. And I can assure you that most of us can't afford the loss. You know, we don't have enough brain to give half of it away to worry, do we? No, we don't. So it says, don't worry. Be anxious for nothing, but in all things by prayer and supplication, let your request be made known unto God. Do you know what that means? You get to ask God for a better solution. Yeah. Right then, you get to pray and ask God. God, if this is what you want me to do, I'm more than willing to do it. But, God, could we have a better solution here? You know, this wasn't in the playbook. This isn't in the plan. Do you know why we can do that? Guess who else did it? What? What'd you say? Jesus did. Yes, he did. Where at? Gethsemane, yes. He got down on his hands and knees before God and he said, God, is there another way? You know, if there is any other way, could this cup pass from me? But then he said, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. In other words, God, if you want me to go die on that hill, I will. And that's what we're supposed to say, isn't it? God, I'd like a better solution than this, but if I have to live this one out right here, doing this just exactly the way it is right now, I'll do it. Be willing to tell God that you're willing to die on that hill. Be anxious for nothing, but in all things by prayer and supplication with what? Thanksgiving. Yes, you thank God for the problem. I tell you, that changes your attitude. When you start looking at life in terms of the things that God is sending to you to change you and more like to make you more like Jesus Christ, instead of looking at everything like a catastrophe or a disaster, you can quit worrying. You don't have to worry about things that God is sending to you to make you as a better person. You don't have to be angry about them either, and you don't have to be fearful. None of those things. You can just look at them for what they are and thank God for them. With thanksgiving, let your request be made known unto God. And then what do you get if you do this? Peace. Yes, yeah, something that the world doesn't have and it can't buy and doesn't come in a bottle. Right? Yes. And the peace of God that passes all understanding shall keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. And then I tell folks, after that, you have to go to the verse 8 where it tells you to think about the things, those things that are lovely, good, of good report, so on and so forth. And pick out something out of that list that you can think about that God wants to do something about. And that you can do something about. Now look at the drill in your notes real quick, okay? Because this is what I do when I start worrying. This is exactly what I do. I stop it as soon as I recognize it. I confess it to God for what it is. I ask God to forgive me. I ask Him to enable me and strengthen me to think about something else to work on. I recite Philippians 4:4-9. And then I start thinking about those things that I ought to be thinking about instead. And what I found when I do that the distance of time from the time I start to sinfully worry until it's over with gets shorter and shorter every time I faithfully repeat that. So I'd encourage you to teach your counselees that. And what else do PTSD people need to do? Well, as God moved Elijah on, so they need to move on. They need regular hours. They need to sleep at night. They need to get up in the morning. I discourage people who have this kind of problem from working nights or working odd shifts. They need a day job. They need to sleep at night. They need to eat regular meals. That includes 3 square meals a day. They need regular exercise and work. They need to do physical labor. They need to... And when they get a job, I've always found that paying job always reduces anxiety over not having money. And, you know, there's this direct connection between the two. Regular Bible reading and prayer, regular church attendance, fellowship in a small group with accountability, regular Christian service. These people need to get out and serve other people. And I tell you, Christian service is defined like this. You can't do it for a relative. It has to be someone you don't know. It has to be someone that can't pay you, someone who's worse off than you are, and someone that you're going to do 2 hours worth of work for every week. And that's what I send my counselees out to do. It gets their belly buttons out. It gets their noses out of their own belly buttons. And then they need to regularly meet and visit with multiple friends who will hold them accountable daily. That, folks, is the solution to worry. What that amounts to is doing what the Bible says you ought to do when things aren't working out the way that you'd hope they would.